Let's turn back to Luke's Gospel, chapter 9. We've been reading through Luke's Gospel on Sunday mornings, and we've come to the section which begins at verse 18. We've already spent a couple of weeks on this section, and we've thought about the question which Jesus asks in verse 20. Jesus asked his disciples a vital question. Luke chapter 9, verse 20. "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" And Peter answered, "You are the Christ of God." The question was put to all the disciples, and Peter answers for all the disciples. I'm sure the disciples must have been asking themselves that question. They must have been discussing it among themselves over these past weeks. And the disciples are agreed about the answer. So Peter can say it without hesitation for them all: "You are the Christ of God." Now, we spent some time talking about just what Peter meant by that. The word Christ is a Greek word. It means the anointed one. In Hebrew, it would be the Messiah. Peter is saying to Jesus, "You are the Messiah. You are the anointed one." More than that, he says, "You are the Messiah of God. You are God's Messiah. You're the Messiah whom God has chosen. You're the Messiah God has sent. You're the Messiah who does God's work. You're the Messiah who is God's representative, who has God's authority." That is Peter's great certainty. Jesus is the Messiah of God, the Christ of God. Now, what is the background to this? Well, in Old Testament times, God's people were ruled over by a king. They were given a king on earth. And the king was supposed to be the representative for God, the king in heaven. The king on earth was supposed to rule in God's name, with God's authority, doing God's will, bringing God's blessing on the people. Now, the first king over God's people was a total failure. His name was Saul, and he finished his life tragically. But then God chose another king. His name was David, a man after God's own heart. When God chose David to be the king, God told Samuel, the priest, to pour oil over David, perfumed oil. David was anointed with oil. And then the Holy Spirit came on David. He was anointed with the Spirit. And from then on, every king descended from King David was anointed with oil when he became king. And the high priest would pray then that God's Spirit would rest on each king. So every king in Judah was known as an anointed one. But none of the kings really matched up to what a king should be. None of them was really fit to be God's representative, because they were all sinners themselves. Some of the kings were better than others, but they were all selfish. They were all disobedient. None of them was perfectly just and righteous. None of them had all the power and the wisdom and the holiness of God. None of them could rescue God's people from their sins. None of them could put right everything that's gone wrong in the world because they were sinners themselves. And none of them could put themselves right. Well, the prophets in Old Testament times, they saw all this. But they didn't despair. They said, well, one day God will give us a king who really will match up to everything a king is supposed to be. He'll be descended from David, but he'll be different from David and from all the other kings descended from David, because he'll be the perfect king. He really will represent God perfectly. He'll be perfectly wise and perfectly just and perfectly holy, and he'll have all of God's power at his disposal because he'll be perfectly at God's disposal. And he will put everything in the world to rights. He will undo the damage that Adam did when he rebelled against God. He'll break the power of the curse. He'll turn this world back into paradise. He'll save God's people from sin and from pain. He'll save God's people from death itself. He'll rule the whole world. He'll rule it forever. He'll rule it on God's behalf. He'll be a wonderful counselor. He'll be a mighty God. He'll be an everlasting Father. He'll be the Prince of Peace. The prophet said, we've had all these kings, these anointed ones, and none of them were capable of saving us. But one day, a king will come who'll be different. He'll be the anointed one. He'll be the Messiah, the Christ. We looked, didn't we, at some of the great promises that God gave through the prophets about the Messiah who was going to come and what the Messiah would do. He will endure as long as the sun, as long as the moon, through all generations. In his days the righteous will flourish, prosperity will abound till the moon is no more. He will rule from sea to sea, from the river to the ends of the earth. All kings will bow down to him. All nations will serve him. All nations will be blessed through him, and they will call him blessed. That's the Messiah. God's anointed one, the Christ, God's perfect representative. All through Old Testament times, people were looking forward. They were longing for the Messiah to come, the only one who could save the situation, the only one who could turn round the fall, the only one who could save the world. Every Jew had heard about the Messiah. Every faithful Israelite prayed daily that God would send the Messiah. The worse things got in the world, and the more earnestly they would pray, oh God, please send us your Messiah. He's our only hope. Some of them had very mixed up ideas about what the Messiah would do and what he'd be like, but still they looked forward and they longed for this supreme, final Saviour King. And now, Peter says to Jesus, you're the Messiah. You're the Christ of God. I don't know how Peter felt as he said those words. Whether a sort of shiver went down his back as he realised what he was saying. What an awesome thing to say. Peter is standing in front of the one whom people have been dreaming of for thousands of years. And he's here at last. Peter standing in the presence of the man who's going to transform history. The man who's going to change the world forever. The man who's going to rule the universe. I think if I'd been Peter, I'd have been gulping. But then Jesus says something unexpected. Verse 21. Jesus strictly warned them not to tell this to anyone. Well, how weird. Jesus agrees with what Peter has said. Yes, he is the Messiah, he is the Christ. But he says, don't tell anyone. Nobody's to know about this. Well, if the Messiah has come after all this time, the one that everybody's been waiting for, then surely everybody should know about it. Surely the disciples should rush out and shout it to the whole world. Surely that's their duty. But Jesus says, no, I don't want you to tell anyone that I'm the Christ. So why not? Why weren't the disciples to tell others what they knew was true? Well, I think the main reason was this. I said a few moments ago that many people had very mixed up ideas about the Messiah and what he would be like. They all agreed that the Messiah would put everything in the world right. But most of them were very confused about how he would do it. Nearly all of them imagined that he would do it in some great, triumphant, spectacular way. In a day, or a few weeks at most, the Messiah would sweep away all the evil from the world. In one great triumphant act, the Messiah would set up his kingdom of righteousness and justice. He would bring in his new paradise. Maybe he would call down fire from heaven, which would simply burn up all the wicked across the world. Maybe he'd lead his people in a great war against the Romans and all the other oppressors, and he'd overthrow them all, and he'd create his own empire with Jerusalem as its capital. But one way or another, that's what they were expecting. They were expecting that the Messiah would win one huge victory over all the powers of evil. He would judge the world. He would bring in the glorious new age there and then. That's what Jewish people were expecting. That's what they were praying for. Now you think about it. If the disciples had gone out and started shouting the fact that Jesus had declared himself to be the Messiah, what would have happened? Well, all over the country, people would have risen up to make Jesus king. They'd have come from all directions, armed with their swords, to crown Jesus as emperor there and then. They'd have been marching on Herod's palace. They'd have been looting the tax offices. They'd have been attacking every Roman outpost and slaughtering the garrisons. You know, a few weeks back we saw a popular uprising in Egypt, didn't we? Hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people out on the streets, determined to bring down an unpopular government. Well, it would have been like that. Only, I think, far more violent, because these Jewish people believed that it was the Messiah's job to slaughter all their enemies. They'd have been fighting in his name to do just that. And what would have been the outcome? Well, either this revolution would have been successful, and Jesus would have been dragged to Jerusalem and set up as a figurehead for this new kingdom, a kingdom created by violence and massacre, or the revolution would have been a failure. And there'd have been a long, drawn-out conflict like the one that's developing in Libya. Either way, the new world wouldn't have been the new paradise that the prophet spoke of. Because even if the revolution succeeded, even if the mob set up Jesus as their king, what sort of kingdom would he have been ruling over? A kingdom of sinners. People's hearts wouldn't have been changed. Oh yeah, the openly wicked Romans would all have been slaughtered. No more of their orgies, no more of their perversions, no more of the slave trade. But what would you be left with? A kingdom of people unchanged, people with pride in their hearts, and selfishness and deceit and greed, people like you and me. You can't change people's hearts by revolutions and wars and massacres. You can change governments. You can change administrations. You can change the political system. But that doesn't turn bad people into good people. The real problem with the world isn't that we've got the wrong political systems in place. The problem with the world is that human beings everywhere have got wicked, selfish hearts. It's because people have got wicked hearts that they create bad political systems. It's that way round. Changing the system doesn't change their hearts. Any political system can go rotten because human beings are rotten inside. There's something twisted about us. That's why children tell lies without ever being taught to. That's why they bully one another without ever being taught to. That's why as they get older, they become more and more vicious and greedy. There's something rotten in the human heart. Oh yes, the crowd could have set Jesus up as some sort of king through violent revolution. But it would have been a kingdom of sinners. Oh yeah, if they had done it, well then the world would have had a wonderful king. But it would have been a world of guilty, wicked, unforgiven sinners. Men and women would still have been proud. They'd still have been greedy. In their hearts they'd still have been rebels against God. When the Old Testament prophets promised that one day the Messiah would come and put the world to right, they weren't just saying that he would change the political system. They were saying that he would deal with the problem of human sinfulness. He would rescue people from guilt. He would put right what's wrong in his people's hearts. He would bring people back individually, personally, to love God, to know God, to trust God, to obey God. That's the reason why Jesus forbade the disciples to tell people that he was the Christ. They wouldn't have understood. They'd have had completely wrong ideas about what it meant. And then they'd have acted on those ideas. I mean, the last passage we looked at in verses 10 to 17 was about the feeding of the 5,000. Well, John in his gospel tells us what happened straight after that episode. He tells us that then those 5,000 men whom Jesus had just fed tried to set Jesus up as king. He gave them this massive handout of food, and they thought it'd be great to have a king like that. A king who'd give them everything they wanted. None of them would ever go hungry again. None of them would ever have to go out to work again. They were ready to march against the Romans there and then. They were ready to crown Jesus there and then. Well, if the news had gone out that Jesus had actually declared himself to be the Messiah, it wouldn't have just been 5,000 men marching. It would have been 1 million men in arms overnight. And Jesus says, that's not what I'm here for. That's not the way my kingdom's going to be set up. That's not the way I'm going to rescue the world. And then Jesus begins to explain to the disciples just how his kingdom is going to be set up. Verse 22, and he said, the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests and teachers of the law, and he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. Every other king imagines that he's going to set up his kingdom by killing his enemies, overthrowing them, seizing power. Jesus, the Messiah, says, I'm going to set up my kingdom by suffering and being rejected and being killed. and then on the third day, rising again. That's Jesus' program for setting up the kingdom. That's the way the Messiah is going to rescue the world and bring in his new age. Now, there are four things I want us to see here in Jesus' words in verse 22. Firstly, the title that Jesus used for himself. Secondly, the sufferings he expected for himself. Thirdly, the necessity he spoke of for himself. And then fourthly, the victory he foresaw for himself. Those are the four points I want us to think about in verse 22. I don't expect to get through all four this morning. We may well only get through the first of them. Firstly, though, the title that Jesus used for himself. Peter has just called Jesus the Christ, the Messiah of God, with all the wealth of meaning that's there in that title. And Jesus doesn't say no to that. But when Jesus answered Peter, he used a different title for himself. The time wasn't right for Jesus to be proclaimed as the Christ, the Messiah. People, as we've said, would misunderstand that. Jesus preferred simply to be known as the Son of Man. And that's the title he uses for himself here. When Jesus was mixing with the crowds, that was the title he normally did use for himself. So when Peter and the other disciples went out from now on to speak about Jesus, if people asked, well, who is this Jesus? Then this is what they should answer. Well, Jesus says he's the Son of Man. That's the chosen title that Jesus takes. Now, what did that mean? When Jesus used that title for himself, what did it mean? Well, on one level, it would simply mean that Jesus was human. Peter has called him the Christ of God. And Jesus says, yes, I am that, but I'm also the Son of Man. I'm a real human being. I'm not just a visitor from another world. I'm not an alien. I'm not maybe an angel or an archangel. I'm a real man. I'm a son of man. But then it would mean more than that. Because the Hebrew word for man is just Adam. Jesus is saying, I'm a son of Adam. The Messiah was to be a son of David, an heir of David. And yes, Jesus is that, but his ancestry goes back further than that. He's a son of Adam. And not just a son of Adam, he is the son of Adam. That's what he's calling himself here. He is Adam's heir, with all that that means. You'd have to read Genesis 1 to 3 very carefully, and then maybe read Psalm 8 to see just what that does mean. Adam was created to rule the world, to rule over all created beings. That was Adam's destiny. Well, if Jesus is Adam's son, then Jesus is going to rule the universe. Psalm 8, verses 4 to 6. What is man that you are mindful of him? The son of Adam, that you care for him. You crowned him with glory and honor. You made him ruler over the works of your hands. You put everything under his feet. When Jesus calls himself the Son of Adam, the Son of Man, that's what he's claiming for himself. It's another way of saying that he's the Messiah. He's the one who's going to rule the universe. He's going to have all things under his feet. He's going to enter into the destiny that Adam forfeited. Adam was told to rule the world in God's name, and he blew it. But Jesus, the son of Adam, the heir of Adam, he at last is going to enter into that inheritance. But remember that being the son of Adam has a darker side as well. Because remember, Adam was cursed. Adam was sentenced to death. Adam was humbled. The serpent who had tempted Adam into sin was then allowed to torment him and all his children. So Psalm 8 puts it this way, that the Son of Man is to be made a little lower than the heavenly beings. If Jesus is the Son of Man, the Son of Adam, then above all men he's going to have to take the weight of the curse. He's going to be brought low. He's going to face death. Satan is going to torment him and strike at his heel. Before the Son of Man can take his place ruling over the universe, he's first going to be humbled in a terrible and tragic way. He's the heir of Adam. He's the child who inherits all our demerits. So if he's the Son of Man, well, he's human. He's Adam's heir. But more than that, he's the true representative of God's people. Don't have time to take you through this properly this morning, but you'll find it all in Psalm 80. You could study that psalm perhaps during this afternoon. In that psalm, Psalm 80, God's people, God's nation, Israel, is given the title, the Son of Man. That's Psalm 80, verse 17. Let your hand rest on the man at your right hand, the Son of Man you've raised up for yourself. God's people together are the new humanity, the heirs of Adam. But now Jesus takes that title for himself. He's the Son of Man. He himself personally represents all God's true people. In Psalm 80, God's people, the Son of Man, are under God's wrath. Well then, if Jesus is the Son of Man, he'll take that wrath on himself. The wrath that's on the people of God will be focused on him. In Psalm 80, God's people are praying that God will raise them up and save them. Well, how's that going to happen? It's going to happen through God raising up Jesus. He really is the representative of God's true people. He really does take their punishment on himself. They really do receive salvation through him. His destiny and theirs are locked together. All of that's built into the title Son of Man. But there's still more. When Jesus used the title the Son of Man, yes, he was saying he's human. Yes, he's saying he's Adam's heir. Yes, he's saying he's the true representative of God's people. But more than that, Jesus was saying that he's going to sit on God's throne. He's going to share God's glory as God's equal. It's all there in Daniel chapter 7. In that chapter, Daniel tells us about a great vision he has. Daniel sees all the great empires and emperors of history. In turn, these great emperors set themselves up and try to run the world. And in Daniel's vision, he sees them as they really are, beastly, horrible, monstrous. And all of those emperors and empires pass away, they're destroyed. But then we have this in Daniel chapter 7, verse 13. In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was one like a Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days, the Eternal God, and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, And his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. And now Jesus says, I'm the Son of Man. I'm the Son of Man Daniel spoke about. We need to take this in. Because it's staggering what Jesus is saying. I mean, put it in the context here in Luke's Gospel. Remember, we looked at it in verse 19. The crowds were saying, Jesus is just a prophet. Jesus is just a man, an ordinary man, a sinful man, a great teacher, no doubt, but one of many. People still say it about Jesus. He's a great moral teacher. He's someone we can learn a lot from, but he's just a man. I've heard people say Jesus never claimed to be anything more than just a man. But Jesus called himself the Son of Man. And he was referring to that passage from Daniel. Do you remember in front of the high priests he said, you shall see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven. And that's a direct quote from Daniel 7. And that's what Jesus believed about himself. Jesus, a village carpenter from Nazareth, said that he was going to be given authority, glory, and sovereign power. Now the key word there is the word glory. Everywhere the Bible shouts out the fact that glory is for God alone. God says, I will not share my glory with anyone else. And now Jesus says, well, I'm the Son of Man, and I am going to share God's glory. All peoples, nations, and men of every language will worship me, says Jesus. My dominion will be an everlasting dominion. It'll never pass away, says Jesus. My kingdom is one that will never be destroyed, says Jesus. Peter had used one title for Jesus. You're the Christ. Jesus says, no, let's use the term Son of Man for now. But that wasn't going down a step. Because this title, Son of Man, is just as big, it's just as mind-blowing as the title Messiah. Jesus is claiming the right to be worshipped. Only God should be worshipped. And yet Jesus is saying that he has the right to be worshipped. He's the Son of Man who is worshipped in Daniel 7. He's to be worshipped by people everywhere for all time, for all eternity. Now just let the bigness of that sink into your mind. We're talking about a Jewish workman who's been wandering the countryside for the past year or so with no home of his own. Often sleeping rough, no money, none of the trappings of power. And he calmly stands there and says, I'm the Son of Man. The Son of Man. He's saying the whole universe is going to have to worship me. We don't have the option of just calling Jesus a good man. Of saying he's one of the great moral teachers. Jesus is saying he's God's equal. Jesus is saying he's destined to share God's glory. He claims the right to be worshipped. Either we accept that claim or we simply say he's crazy. There's no middle course. That's the assessment you have to make about Jesus. But before you make that assessment, bear two things in mind. Firstly this. The people to whom Jesus said this, Peter and the other disciples, they were the people who knew Jesus best. They knew him as well as it's possible to know anyone. They had travelled with him. They had listened to him. They had eaten with him. They'd watched him in public. They'd watched him in private. And when Jesus came out with these words, when Jesus declared himself to be the Son of Man, the one who is to be worshipped by all nations forever, they didn't fall over laughing. They said, yes, we know it's true. And they did worship him. They were going to spend the rest of their lives worshipping him. They were willing to die for him because they believed it so totally. They did die for him. Never forget that. These men were so convinced that Jesus really was the Christ, that he really was the Son of Man, that they were willing to be imprisoned and tortured and burned alive or crucified rather than leave him. Remember that. The people who knew him best were 100% convinced. If anybody else had made that claim, if anybody else had said, I'm the Son of Man, I'm going to share the glory of God and sit with him on his throne, I think these disciples would have fallen over laughing. But when Jesus says it, they say, yes, that fits. That fits you. They believe it. And they're willing to die for it. And then remember this secondly. However insane it seemed at the time, it has come true, hasn't it? Already these words of Jesus are coming true. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. That's what the destiny of the Son of Man was to be. And it's happening. Alexander the Great claimed to be a god. He wanted people to worship him. How many people worship Alexander the Great today? Most of the Roman emperors claimed to be gods and wanted people to worship them. How many temples are there in the world now to Nero or to Caligula where people gather to sing their praises? But Jesus, this Jewish workman who never led an army, who never founded a university, who never wrote a book, this man who finished his life strung out naked on a cross, 2,000 years later, is worshipped. And he's worshipped by people all over the world. It might have seemed crazy then to suggest that a village carpenter from the foothills of northern Palestine would one day be worshipped in every nation of the world. But he's being worshipped today in the far-off islands of Britain, isn't he? Today we're here. We're singing hymns about him. We're talking about him. We're praying in his name. And there are people who will gather in Singapore. And there are people who will gather in all the different African countries. And there'll be people who gather in the Arctic and the Antarctic. And who'll be worshipping Jesus today. The fact that we are here today is the proof that what Jesus said about himself was true. 2,000 years after Jesus died, there are people here in this room, thousands of miles from where Jesus was born, who love Jesus more than they love their friends, more than they love their wives, more than they love their children. There are people here who have given up huge things for him and who would give up their lives for him if it was necessary. Who else in all history has ever had that sort of compelling power over the hearts of men and women? You know, I've met people who say, oh, I honour the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. I follow him. But I've never met anyone who said, I love Muhammad. He's my dearest friend. He's my master. He's my Lord. But people from every nation under the sun who find out about Jesus feel that way about him. They really do worship him. Not just in the sense that they go to church and say nice things about him, but that their hearts are overflowing with love for him. People living in the middle of the South American jungles hear about Jesus. They hear about a man who lived 2,000 years earlier in a country that they'd never heard of before. And they say, ah, that's what we've been waiting to hear about. He's the one we want to worship. People who are locked up in prisons for the most horrible crimes and who hate everybody and everything hear about Jesus and say, ah, I can love him. And they start to worship him. People who are millionaires in the wealthiest communities in the world, who have never worshipped anything but money, they hear about Jesus and they're drawn to him, and their love for money just shrivels away and they begin to worship Jesus. When Jesus called himself the Son of Man, was he crazy? Or was he right? People ask for evidence. We are the evidence. There is something impossible about a meeting like this. Utterly impossible. It is impossible that a man should die as a criminal, and that then 2,000 years later people should gather in countries thousands of miles away from where he died to say, oh, we love him, we love him, we adore him, we worship him, we want to serve him. That is impossible. Unless he was who he said he was. Unless he really was the Son of Man. Unless that really was God's eternal plan, that Jesus should be worshipped by people from every nation and tongue. Unless Jesus really is the one who is going to reign forever and ever over all nations and over the universe. Are you a worshipper of Jesus? I'm not asking, do you believe in him in your head? That's one thing. I'm not asking, do you come along to church and do your best to follow what's said? I'm not asking, do you know the hymns and can you sing them? I'm asking, are you a worshipper of Jesus? Do you find it in your heart that something thrills within you at the sound of his name? Do you find yourself saying, yes, 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 it's him, he's supremely important. Yeah, he deserves my love and he's going to have my love. Do you find that you want just to be his and to give everything you have and everything you are to him? That's what it means to worship someone. That's what it means to worship Jesus. God the Father wants us to worship his Son. And there are millions of people all around the world who have had their heart warmed so they do worship his Son. And what about you? What about you? Maybe you say, no. No, I don't feel that way about Jesus. And that says something horrible about you. It says you've got a cold, self-centered heart. It means you've got eyes that are blind to the truth. If you really had open eyes, you would look at Jesus and you'd say, oh, he's wonderful. Maybe you ought to start praying that God will open your eyes, that God will help you to see Jesus in his beauty and in his glory, and you will start to worship this Son of Man.